The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to this special live streaming edition of the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way for you to keep on top of all the news out of China with our daily access email newsletter, our website, which is just chock full of terrific original reported pieces as well as op-eds, and of course, through our ever-widening range of videos and podcasts. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Joining me from Nashville, Tennessee, is the man singly responsible for the hoarding of most of the state's toilet paper, and especially paper towels, which he's stored in this enormous warehouse, which serves as a cult headquarters also for him. And they've been there since March. I've told him he should stack them inside that room that he's recording in to absorb some of that nasty echo and vastly improve his damn audio, but he just never listens. You never listen, Jeremy. Jeremy, greet the people.
Hello, people. I mean, of all the things that I might hoard, toilet paper is definitely not one of them. But I'm amazed. I don't know if this is the same around the country. There are still toilet paper and paper towel shortages. Like, our local supermarket is still restricted to buy only two packets at once.
Insane.
Anyway.
As you say, anyway. As most of our listeners are doubtless aware, Beijing has set a very ambitious goal for itself, the complete eradication of poverty in China this year, 2020. We thought we'd do a bit of a reality check and see how the rhetoric and the reality actually compare. Have the goals been derailed by the COVID-19 pandemic? Has poverty actually been eradicated? How is poverty actually measured? How should we think about the successes and the shortfalls in poverty alleviation to date?
Joining us to discuss all of this is Gao Qian, who was on our show a few years ago when we could still record things in person, those lovely old days. I have such nostalgia. Gao Qian is a professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work and the founding director of the Columbia China Center for Social Policy. She's a leading authority on China's social welfare system. She's also on the faculty of the Weatherhead East Asian Institute of Columbia University and a public intellectual fellow of the National Committee on United States-China Relations. Last time she was on the show, we talked about her book, Welfare, Work and Poverty, Social Assistance in China. And right now, as luck would have it, she is working on a book about our very topic today, China's efforts to eradicate rural poverty by 2020. Gao Qian, welcome back to Seneca.
Very happy to be back. It's a nice gathering. And you're welcome to come to New York and hoard all the things you want. We have plenty.
Also joining us is Matthew Chitwood. Matt spent 2 years in a remote mountain village in Yunnan province in southwestern China, where he observed firsthand the drastic social and economic change that's taking place in rural China. He's only been back in the U.S. for, a few months now, but he previously taught at some of the better-known study abroad programs in China, including CET and CIEE, and Where There Be Dragons. He also worked for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the United States Department of Critical Language Scholarship Program, where he was secretly embedding chips in innocent Chinese rural people, you know, in accordance with Bill Gates's sinister plot. That's shameful. Matt is an alum not only of the Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS, but also of the Hopkins Nanjing program, the excellent Mandarin program there in Nanjing. He's also currently working on a book based on his fellowship research in rural Yunnan. Matt, welcome to Seneca. Great to have you.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here. And I would say welcome to Idaho as well, but if you try to come hoard our toilet paper, you might find your life in danger there, so be careful.
You have more guns than New Yorkers, huh?
We well, I don't know about that. Not sure about the ratio there. Legally registered ones, yeah.
We thought the two of these guests would just make a terrific pair to tackle this particular topic, of course, because Gaochen can give the quantitative, the big picture, the sort of national level view about, you know, policy development and major approaches to poverty alleviation, while Matt can give us, you know, a real sense of how all this translates into reality on the ground.
So let's start with the big picture and with Gaochen. How much of a personal project is this of Xi Jinping's? Did he significantly prioritize poverty eradication and make it a signature project? That is certainly the impression I get from my daily reading of the Chinese state media. It has been one of the major themes associated with Xi on an almost daily basis. But was this something that you imagine would have been recognized as within reach or as a priority for any Chinese leader and as something worth investing in?
It's certainly a signature campaign launched by Xi Jinping himself in 2013 before it became an official policy. So Xi Jinping first gave a speech about the targeted poverty eradication project in 2013 at the end of the year. And then quickly it became policy and a series of policies rolled out. It's in 2015, it became the official Chinese government's war on poverty. If you read the official newspapers, you see Xi Jinping is all over the country visiting poor villages. A few of them are in Yunnan. So he very much considers this his signature policy. And one of the projects I'm working on is to analyze how the official narrative, including Xi's own narrative, talks about poverty eradication in rural China by the end of this year.
That's fascinating. Staying with you here, Gaochen, is there, to your knowledge, any precedent for this? Are you or Matt, I mean, are you either of you aware of any other major nation in the world that has undertaken something as ambitious as this, as audacious as this, giving itself a quite short-term deadline for the total eradication of poverty?
Matt, if I may, I conduct the research in both the Chinese historical context and the global context. In the Chinese context, the Chinese leaders have always prioritized poverty alleviation, but never before was a clear goal of eradication set. So this is unprecedented in China. In the global context, you guys are probably familiar with the Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty in the 1960s. That was grand and achieved a lot, but it's not entirely finished. In fact, there's a body of literature looking at the progress and the shortfalls of that campaign. In the UK, Tony Blair tried to end child poverty during his government. They achieved a lot, but again, not a kind of eradication at this
great,
scale.
Great.
So let's review the metrics. How does China actually define poverty? How does that compare to other countries, whether developing or developed? I remember, Gaochen, being quite surprised when we last spoke with you on a podcast at how China actually counts its poor. Could you describe the metrics?
Yes, I think Matt has some on-ground evidence on this, but China right now defines poverty based on an income poverty line that was set in 2010. Back then, it was 2,300 yuan per person per year, and that's for the rural areas. So it's a rural national income poverty line. Every year, it's adjusted. In this year, it's about 4,000 yuan per person per year. In the US, we still use an income poverty line as well, but the calculations are a little bit different. In many other European countries, they use a relative poverty line, whereas the Chinese and the US poverty lines are absolute. So it's set at a certain level, and we compare people's income to that line. In Europe and other countries, they use a relative poverty line, which calculates the poverty standard or threshold using 50 or 60% of a society's median income level. So it's tied to the median income level and to some extent the relative income distribution in a society.
Just out of curiosity, if China were to use a relative poverty line and assess it at, say, 50% of median income, would that be significantly above the level that it sets right now at an absolute?
Yes, it's much higher. And poverty eradication would be much harder.
If I can ask both of you to just put this in layperson's terms, are poor Chinese people poorer than poor Europeans and Americans or not? Are they richer?
I think that one of the things that I took away from being in the village and seeing this campaign in action, one, metrics super, super important to knowing what you're measuring and how you're making progress on that. And so then you have a standard that you can compare across the country and also to other countries. I would say, you know, the metrics that Dr. Gao was talking about, I was struck by, you know, the campaign sounds large and grandiose, right? We're going to eradicate poverty by 2020. Oh my gosh, that's incredible. Only the Communist Party can accomplish something like that, right? At the same time, and I will say, yes, it is an incredible feat when they do it by the end of this year. At the same time, it's a fairly low bar that they're setting, right? So roughly what I saw was about $500 US per person per year. The other metrics that I saw them using on the ground, it was a 1-2-3 campaign. So one, the income threshold of about 500 US per person per year. Two being two no worries. So not having to worry about food or clothing. And then three guarantees. So safe housing, access to healthcare, access to education. So this 1-2-3 campaign being kind of the standard of metrics. You know, in reality, when the bar is that low, yes, they are absolutely still very poor. So I remember sitting down with my neighbor Lee in the village and going over, how his life had changed prior to being officially impoverished 2 years prior and then being officially lifted out of poverty as I was sitting with him. And, you know, what he expressed to me is, I guess I'm not poor anymore, but I sure feel very poor still. So compared to, I don't know how that compares to other countries, but compared to themselves, prior to that campaign, after that campaign, there is still very much a sense of being poor, but at the same time, you have to start somewhere. And I think that's the importance of these metrics. That's the importance of this very intentional campaign. To start somewhere, I think this hopefully builds momentum and hopefully rolls into something that continues into the future to make the lives of my neighbors better.
They're starting, in this case, with rural poverty. How significant, Gaoqin, is it that it's only rural poverty, which is actually considered poverty in the Chinese? I mean, that was one of the surprising things that I took away from our last conversation, too, and from reading your book. Do you, either of you have maybe numbers around, if that poverty standard were applied in an urban setting, would that significantly expand the number of people in poverty in China? Or is that low enough that it doesn't make sense, that it does make sense that it not be included in China's measure of poverty?
Thank you, Kaiser. This is an important and good question. If we apply the rural poverty line to urban areas, urban poverty is extremely low, about, I think, below 2%. So urban poverty based on this standard is not an issue. That's partly why the Chinese government decided they're going to concentrate on rural poverty. Another aspect is the contexts of urban versus rural China is so different. In rural areas, people used to have no social protection, very little healthcare protection, pensions. Now they have more of it, more of the kind of social protection. But at the same time, income inequality has been rising so rapidly. So as Matt just mentioned, people, even after escaping poverty, still feel poor. They certainly don't feel they're living a good life compared to the well-off, especially those in the cities, who live a glamorous life. Of course, in urban areas, there are those who suffer. And that's another issue. I think the Chinese government will pay attention to it, to urban poverty after 2020. But rural poverty is at a different scale and different depth than urban poverty. Another thing Matt just talked about, the 1-2-3 standards, the one, which is the income standard, is easier to be met. The 2 no worries and 3 assurances are harder. Many rural areas have...
Gaoqing, could you just explain the 2 no worries and the 3 assurances?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, this is great. I mean, I'll do it. I'll try, see if I remember it. 一打表, 两不愁, and 三保障, right?
The one standard is the income standard, meeting the poverty threshold. The 2 no worries is not to worry about food and clothing, right? The 3 assurances are to assure people have access to education, healthcare, and housing. But in rural areas, to achieve the 2 no worries, especially the 3 assurances, are much harder because you require so much infrastructure building. I know from where I grew up in Shanxi, the mountainous areas, to have water, clean water, is no easy feat. And if the government can bring that to the poor people, that's one major achievement.
Absolutely.
So, a new, I think, government website at the URL fpzg.cpad.gov.cn.
Easy to remember.
Has a countdown clock. Yeah, very easy to remember. This website has a countdown clock to the end of poverty, and it's, of course, set for the end of this year. So we have, right now, 126 days and just under 14 hours to go. So let's not keep our audience in suspense, Matthew and Gaoqing. Let's do the reality check, as promised, and put the big question plainly. Is China on track to actually eradicate poverty? At least by its own definition of poverty, by the end of the year.
Matt, go ahead.
Put a cop out. Oh, man, put it on me. Okay. The quick and easy answer is absolutely. China is absolutely going to eradicate poverty by the end of this year. You can fully expect to see headlines to that effect coming out this fall, and the progress that they've made, the huge numbers, and poverty is gone. But again, what's important to realize is the contextualization of that, what that actually means, what the metrics are that Dr. Gao was just talking about, and the low bar that is. So why I say absolutely, I mean, we've seen incredible progress in this. So, you know, 2012, about 100 million people were officially impoverished. At the end of last year, that was reduced to 5.5 million. And Dr. Gao has some great reports on this with charts that, you know, have the amount of financing that the government has put into this, you know, going up exponentially. So if you just look at the amount of money going into this at the end of last year and divide that by 5.5 million people, you know, they are all out of poverty and millionaires. Actually, they're, you know, doing quite well with that money if they were to do that. So absolutely, those 5.5 million people are going to be lifted out of poverty by the end of this year. But yeah, important context is realizing that's a very low bar. It's only extreme rural poverty. We're not talking about urban poverty at all. And then the questions of, you know, moving forward, what happens after they achieve that goal, right? How sustainable has this effort been? How much of it is, entrepreneurship and income generating opportunities that have come to people now, and how much is it dependence upon the government to continue to not be impoverished?
And could I ask a follow-up question? If, like your neighbor Lee, sufficient numbers of people watch the daily news broadcast or read the headlines on their mobile phone that says China has eradicated poverty, and there are a number of them that feel, but I'm still really poor. Is there a danger here for the Communist Party of, you know, blowing their own trumpet a little too loudly?
So what I heard on the ground, I think was a balance of two things. Obviously, there's always going to be grumbling, right? One thing I heard was 九牛一毛, right? So like, you know, 9 cows and 1 hare. So what the government is putting into rural areas or providing people is just a drop in the bucket, you know, compared to what they have or what would be able to do. So there's grumbles about that, about local poor implementation, grumbles about corruption, of course. But broadly speaking, what I heard was their lives are materially better. And they're better off now than they have ever been before. So even my neighbor Lee, where he would say he's still poor, comparing to what his life was like, you know, 20 years ago, he's living his best life right now, materially far better off. And the poverty eradication campaign has contributed to that. He does have more money to renovate his house. Some, that's been a big part of the policy that I saw in the village where I lived, new houses that went up because people got free money from the government, they got low interest loans from the government, and they borrowed from family and friends to do it right, when they're building a house for the first time. So I think their lives are markedly improved. They feel that materialistically. And so when they themselves hear those headlines, I don't think they would be bitter or feel like it's just a lie or propaganda. And I think you see that in approval rates, government approval rates as well. I think some of us are familiar with the Ash Center at Harvard. They just came out with a report looking at, you know, the resilience of the Communist Party in China and how that's gone. They started doing surveys in 2003, and released a report last month saying, approval rates of the Communist Party, are at an all time high, compared to the last two decades, which is significant, and that there was greater satisfaction in these low-income inland areas in China. So places like this village where I was living, compared to city or areas addressing urban poverty.
Yeah, I would just add very quickly that we just ran a piece on Sub China, which looks at the Ash Center study kind of with a critical eye. It'd be probably a good perspective to have on this as well. I'm curious though. We usually talk about when we look at the Liang Bao Zhang, or I'm sorry, the Liang Bu Chou. We usually think of it as a trio of things: food, clothing, and shelter. You mentioned all this new building of houses. Why is shelter not included among the three? The two no worries.
So shelter would be included in the three assurances or the three guarantees in that third one. And safe housing, right? So in the area where I lived, that was a big case to be made for tearing down all the old, you know, rammed earth and wood houses, those structures, tearing those down and building up these 2-3 story concrete blocks, right? I think interestingly, some arguments could be made that those aren't necessarily safer in earthquake-prone zones. In terms of what is safer housing and motivations for that in terms of stimulating the construction economy or whatnot, just interesting questions that arise from that. And also people now having these big homes, non-income generating assets that they've borrowed from family and friends through this eradication campaign, but now they have debt. So are they more, in debt and more impoverished now, or better off? Certainly they think that they are better off in their new homes. And, I would agree, seeing the comparison of the homes that they now live in.
I want to get Gao Qin to weigh in though on this bigger question of has China succeeded or is China on track to succeed? Would you agree with Matt that it is on track by its own measure to succeed in eradicating rural poverty?
I think the official narrative will be the same, that China will succeed in eradicate poverty rural extreme poverty by the end of this year. And already we see official reports, even researchers who claim that already. But I agree with Matt's discussion about the sustainability and what happens post 2020. Researchers are already talking about what poverty will look like. It's not that poverty will no longer exist in the Chinese land. Poverty will exist in dynamic and different ways. In addition to urban poverty, which needs to be addressed, rural poverty will be multifaceted. I'm now doing a new project looking at multidimensional poverty that is not based on an income or consumption level, but based on people's material well-being mm-hmm. and deprivations in these different dimensions. So mm-hmm. those kinds of poverty will exist, and it's a big topic for the government, for scholars, for the public to decide how the Chinese people and the Chinese government will consider poverty
right.
after this year.
It strikes me that $500 a year sounds just abysmally low when we consider that that's less than what the federal government has been giving in additional unemployment subsidies per week to Americans during the COVID-19 pandemic, although that's apparently not going to be the case any longer.
Although, of course, if Chinese can be assured of health care, that might put them way ahead of Americans, no matter how much money they have in the bank. Right.
The other thing is food, of course. I mean, because these people are rural and therefore are either themselves engaged in agriculture or very close to it. So, this multidimensional study that you're going to be doing, it's going to look at factors like caloric intake, presumably, as well, right? And since, you know, the $500 is cash, so if people who are not growing cash crops, who are growing food crops and presumably don't take it all to market, they actually consume part of that. So maybe that's part of it. Anyway, Gaoqin, you have written the most authoritative book in English on how rural poverty alleviation actually works. And the main tool for addressing rural poverty that the Chinese leadership has at its disposal is DBAO. It's a means-tested minimum guaranteed income scheme. DBAO is short for 最低生活保障, or the minimum guarantee minimum, basically, livelihood mm-hmm. guarantee. Last time you were on the show, you went very deep into how the system works and what its main problems are, the problem of leakage and the problem of mistargeting. Could you provide an overview of the DBAO system again and how it works? Just who is and isn't eligible, how it's funded, how the funds are dispersed, what its strengths are, and then what these two conspicuous weaknesses of it are.
Mm-hmm. DBAO is China's primary public assistance program. So anyone who is poor, whose income falls below the local DBAO line or the poverty line, would be able to get the DBAO benefit. And the benefit they get is the difference between their income and the local DBAO line. And for each locality, let's say each province, each county, they have a separate urban and rural DBAO line. So if you are a local resident, you apply and your income is subject to that local line. So the urban and rural lines are very different. And migrants cannot get the DBAO benefit because they don't live in where they have the hukou. So DBAO in recent years, DBAO is meant to be a last resort safety net for the very poor, right? Regardless of whether you can work, how old you are. So it's income based only. But in recent years, I think parallel to this poverty eradication in rural China, DBAO's coverage has declined, both in urban and rural areas. In urban areas, currently it's about only 2.5% of the urban population who can get the DBAO. In rural areas, it's about 7.5-8%. So DBAO's population coverage has declined, which means they really concentrate the benefits to the very poor in the urban and rural areas. Thus brings the problem of mistargeting. That is, if you want only very few people to get the benefit, those who might qualify to get it could be squeezed out. So mistargeting is a continued challenge. I think the government officials are struggling with this as well. But they are also very afraid of the anti-corruption campaign. They're afraid of making a mistake by classifying somebody to be Dibao eligible. But that person, what if is not really eligible, or somebody makes a fuss about that person's eligibility? So Dibao, I think, needs to be re-emphasized and re-looked at to be one of the major policies and programs post 2020. In fact, just 2 days ago, maybe by time difference, it's yesterday here, the Chinese government just issued a new regulation, that is inviting the societies and experts' input about the role of social assistance, which centers around Dibao, going forward. And the goal is by 2035, to have a comprehensive public assistance system in China that's not only Dibao, but surrounded by a network of public assistance programs. I think that's the government's already plan and action to move beyond 2020 to really build a long-term system to support those who have low income or who struggle in these different dimensions.
Besides Dibao, Gaoqin, there must be other tools available. You mentioned other social assistance programs, and these are perhaps not for immediate poverty relief, short-term poverty relief, but for longer-term efforts, the kind of teach a man to fish type of thing, but also roads and electrification. How much impact do those things have, and how important does the government see them as part of poverty eradication efforts?
Yeah, I think, Matt, maybe you can talk about the infrastructure building you witnessed in your village, and then sure. I can talk about the other government
yeah,
programs.
Matt, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, infrastructure development, incredibly important, right? So there's the phrase, 要致富先修路, right? If you want to prosper, first build a road. What I saw, you know, the government was taking that fully to heart. You've seen incredible infrastructure development over the last 10 years in Yunnan. About 10, 15 years ago, 40% of people in Yunnan did not have access to paved roads. And so when you think of places that are agriculture, dependent upon agriculture development, getting their products to market, they cannot. If they don't have roads, and especially in a place like the village where I lived that has a rainy season for 6 months. So when I moved to Bangdong village, they had no road in the village. The first week that I was there, they paved their first road in the village. So that's a game changer for people being able to get their crops in and out, right? They're building a highway right by the village. So by the end of this year, that's supposed to be completed, which instead of the 24-hour overnight bus ride and minivan ride and hitchhiking that it took for me to go from Kunming, the provincial capital, to this village, by the end of this year, that's supposed to be roughly a 5-hour smooth sailing highway drive into the province. So that makes an incredible difference in terms of people's access to markets, not only for their agriculture, cash crops that they're getting into, predominantly tea in the village where I lived, but even access to things like tourism, right? Tourism dollars that are huge, have been huge for the transformation of Yunnan province specifically. And people being able to go out to work. And I think maybe more significantly, access to education and hospitals, healthcare, that's part of this three assurances component of the 1-2-3 campaign. So that makes a huge difference. I can't tell you, we were talking about vulnerability of life, earlier. We're used to social safety nets and, insurance schemes and whatnot. That doesn't exist in these rural areas. And the way that people make their livelihoods, very, very vulnerable. So them needing access to healthcare, hospitals nearby, that infrastructure is critical to a higher quality of life.
Matt, real quick, before we go back to Gaoqin to talk about these other sort of ancillary things besides Diba, how many people, what percentage of people in Bangdong was only, 300-odd people, right?
Yeah, 350 roughly.
Do you happen to know how many of the families were Dibao recipients?
I don't know offhand. of the, I mean, over the course of my time there, basically everyone was officially lifted out of poverty. But that was not, you know, by the end standing on their own two feet. That was receiving these payments from the government, monthly or quarterly. And they would, you know, they would post these on the bulletin board at the, 活动中心, the activity center in the village, you know, the Communist Party activity center. They would post those publicly and actually in a village WeChat group. And then there would always be discussion in that group about who was receiving how much and why, and you know, a little bit of back and forth about that between everyone, some bickering. So that was interesting to see that dynamic play out as well.
Matt, you mentioned, you know, authorities posting publicly information about the debau. And Gaochen, you've written about the social stigma that comes from the very intrusive means testing of the debau system. Can you talk briefly about that and whether the people who administer the system are trying to address this problem?
Yeah, and maybe also answer that earlier question that we had about, you know, other things besides debau. That's a great question, Jeremy.
I'll answer the other social assistance programs first. So right now there's a network of other social assistances such as education, medical, employment, or disasters assistance. So those are catered to those people who are in desperate needs, catering to a very small proportion of the people. And one interesting feature is that the eligibility to those programs are often tied to one's debau eligibility. So if you're receiving debau and you have other needs, then the government officials will come to you and say, okay, you need some medical assistance, we can give it to you. Your kid is going to school, we can support your education. But for those who are not covered by debau, it's much harder to access these additional assistance programs. So this is a challenge in the policy design of the tied eligibility. But I think the government's recent, 2 days ago, issued a new policy is trying to break them so that people who have different kinds of needs can get their needs addressed, and they can leave debau if they have enough income but can benefit from other support they really need. So I think that's one direction. The other thing, Jeremy, you mentioned about employment and education support, right? So boosting the human capital of those who are struggling with poverty. I think that's really important going forward, especially to invest in the education of the children in these poor, low-income households. The government has tried different ways to promote the employability of the people who are suffering from poverty. That's harder. Many of the people who are in poverty either have physical disability or a chronic illness, or they have family care responsibilities that make them hard or impossible to seek out of household job. So those are long-term challenges. I think not only China, other countries, including the US, struggle with this. That is, human capital investment through education works, but through job training doesn't always work. And that's a shared challenge to poverty alleviation in many societies. I'll talk about
social stigma. Yeah.
The stigma, that's a complicated issue. Certainly people who receive welfare suffer from the stigma very much. I think probably more so, probably more so in rural areas because of the close proximity of people's social networks. But in urban areas, they also suffer from it. So I cannot make that quantitative comparison. We just recently published an article looking at how teenagers, adolescents in both urban and rural China whose families received debau, their mental health is quite affected, severely affected. So that's a major concern because in the current design of debau and of poverty eradication, everything is so public. As Matt, you mentioned in your previous talks, you come to a household that houses a poor family. In front of the door, you see this family's basic information posted. How many people live here? How much income they have? Why do they fall into poverty? Do they have somebody who is sick or has a disability? Those are all public, partly to assure there's no mistargeting, that this family is not designated as a poor family for no good reason. But of course, everything becomes public. Another aspect we haven't touched upon is the mass mobilization of this poverty eradication campaign. It's not President Xi who personally comes to rescue all the families out of poverty. It's all the many, many government officials or semi-officials, some teachers, police officers, tax managers, I mean, all kinds of people are involved in lifting these poor people out of poverty. So each household that's designated as poor has a responsible unit and a responsible person who is personally responsible of making that family leave poverty by the deadline, usually before the deadline. So it's not abstract. And to achieve that, it becomes personal. And information is revealed, and not only of the poor household's information, but also the responsible person's information, phone number, what you can do. So it's not the privacy insurance is very hard. And I don't think the government is trying to move in that direction.
Matt, did you see this problem of social stigmatization of people who were DBAL recipients or recipients of other social assistance in Guangdong?
I think the most conflict I saw over it was actually, the conflict over who received what and how much rather than the actual social stigma. So two dynamics of that. So in the village where I was, it seemed just on the cusp of people starting to have some economic opportunity, right? So they'd gotten into cash crop of tea 5-10 years earlier, and some people were actually doing okay with that, right? And some people were still, you know, at this minimum threshold, very, very poor. And so the question of, you know, that level of inequality, even in a small community, what does that look like? How does that affect relationships? I think the other dynamic was, for example, with another neighbor of mine, neighbor Zhang, who his parents were old and unable to work. He had two kids in school. His wife had mental health issues, and he himself was an alcoholic. And so he did not work. And so government, you know, government handout to him and his family, that was a topic of conversation in the village as to whether he should receive that or not, or kind of discussed with him. You know, the local government sent contractors to come fix up his house for him, to come teach him how to sweep his house and maintain his house. Did he follow up on that? Did he continue that maintenance? No. And so, social, not unrest, but a disagreement in the village about cases like that. Is that right? Should he receive that? Consensus was he should receive a little bit so that he's not starving. But anything beyond that, they would be disgusted with because he's not working and he doesn't deserve that.
Speaking about people working or not working, Gaoqin, after Andrew Yang's presidential campaign, where he talked quite a bit about universal basic income or UBI, to the exclusion of
did he talk about anything else?
He really did. Later on, he wrote op-eds about how we Chinese Americans should drape ourselves in the flag, but whatever. Anyway, disappointed with him. But now, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic, here in the U.S., people have begun talking more and more about some form, either UBI or a minimum guaranteed income, some form of this kind of assistance. So has this been happening in China, too? Has this conversation been taking place in China, too? Is there more discussion about such things? And how receptive to such ideas do China's people and China's leaders appear to be?
That's an important topic and one I'm very invested in. Universal basic income in China is being discussed among very small circles of scholars and some international organizations. For example, the UNDP organized a small group discussion about 2 years ago. So there are some discussions, but the consensus is that the Chinese government will not buy into it. China is too big, and this fundamental debate about who is the deserving poor, who is the non-deserving poor, is forever there. And that's part of the Chinese culture, how people think who could and is entitled to government support. So certainly similar to what we face in the US, this deserving versus non-deserving debate is ongoing and political. I think in this area, China and the US are similar, that a lot of people, including politicians, are against the idea of universal basic income. So I don't see China going in that direction in the short run anytime soon. But China is moving in that direction in some areas of social policy, such as education support, right? So the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao administration eliminated education fees for rural students and launched the compulsory education. That was big. That before that, one would never imagine that. Now the government is also moving into investment in early education, 0 to 3, 0 to 6. And that's tying back to our earlier discussion about human capital investment. I think that's important. And that can be universal. People don't have controversies about children's values and potential contributions to the future.
Right.
But one area that we debate about is mental health. Alcohol use, right? People look down upon that. I think in China going forward, two things, mental health challenges and also family care responsibilities are going to be important discussions.
I'm always telling people that the Chinese Communist Party actually has a lot in common with the GOP in this idea that they cling to this meritocratic mythology, to this idea. I mean, so yeah, they could invest in early education because they think that's about getting people to the starting line or whatever equally. But they are very invested in this idea of sort of rugged individual bootstrapping and all that, and this belief in meritocratic competition. And, you know, a lot of poor Chinese still think of themselves just as Americans do, as just temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
So on another subject, how has COVID-19 impacted China's push to eradicate poverty?
Yeah, I saw a lot of articles about how it supposedly set it back quite a bit. You think that's the case, both of you?
I'm writing an article about that based on official newspaper reports. In the newspaper narratives, no. The Chinese government is so determined that they will achieve this goal no matter what. It could be COVID, it could be the floods, other kinds of setbacks, but that doesn't stop the Chinese government reaching the poverty eradication goal. And I mean, given the limited time we have, it's not hard to meet the 1-2-3 standards. You just invest money. And the Chinese government in the short run has that amount of money.
Yeah, exactly. And I would just add, it will not affect their ability to achieve the goal, but it has affected people's lives in rural areas, right? Deeply.
That's, I was going to ask, Matthew, if you're still in touch with people in Guangdong, do you have a sense of how they were affected by the pandemic?
Yeah, so they weren't affected directly at all by, you know, infection or anything like that. But supply chains for agriculture supplies, right? Being able to have their seed or fertilizer or, whatnot for their livestock. And agriculture cycles, right? If that's happening in the spring, we haven't even seen the effects of, you know, their ability or inability to plant and harvest for their agriculture inputs. So that's very significant. Perhaps more significant is people's ability to go out and resume their jobs in the factories, right? So the migrant workers who is a large percentage of rural populations and where they get their income, unable to go out to factories that aren't opened up again, and they don't have social income guarantees or unemployment, and so they're just out of work. And you can't just jump right back into being a farmer in the village. So I think a study that Stanford REAP did estimated about $100 billion in lost wages for those migrant workers who are at home and unemployable and no income.
I agree. I think COVID affects the millions of migrant workers and the low income and near poor, even middle class families in urban areas much more. A lot of rural areas are able to not get infected too much, but urban areas, it's much harder. And the supply chain, the ability to go out and make a living and sustain the level of livelihood, it's much harder. And that's not discussed in the context of the poverty eradication.
Mm-hmm. Matt, you've spoken before about how outside observers will sometimes romanticize the very things that contribute most directly to poverty, and maybe even will romanticize poverty itself. Tell us the story. I've heard you tell it before, and I thought it was intriguing, about your own epiphany in this regard. About, I think his name was Liu Ge, older brother.
Liu Da Ge. So he was a guy in the village. He became, I would say, my best friend there. 50-year-old guy, stood up to about my shoulder, born and raised in Bangdong, which, has always been an impoverished village. He helped me renovate a little old traditional home there in the village, which was my house for the 2 years. And one day after working on that house together, we were walking through the village back to his house on the single loop dirt road that goes through the village. And this idea, I looked out at the mountains and I had this just spiritual experience of, oh my gosh, they just go fade to blue into the horizon, and the tea terraces, right? Amazing tea terraces just go down into the river, and these bamboo fronds, incredibly picturesque. And you would have, people who would pay a lot of money to live in a place like that with that view. But, so I turn to Brother Leo and I say, you were born here. Like, is the beauty of this lost on you, or do you still appreciate this? Or is it just boring normal to you? And he said, it's because of these mountains that we are poor. And I was blown away by his answer, just, recognizing, and Dr. Gao was speaking to this earlier, the degree that their lives have been cut off from economic opportunity. He was born poor and he still is poor because of these mountains. So not only that, but also for me personally, realizing that something as innocuous as a mountain, we could see it so differently based on our different life experiences.
Let's bring this back to the main question of how China is doing in its overall poverty eradication goal. Gaochen, you've been pretty critical of Dibao for the leakage and mistargeting and stigmatization of poverty, but you also write quite positively about the overall success that China's had in at least significantly reducing poverty. Can you give us a sense of what China has achieved?
I think we need to give the Chinese government the credit of focusing on poverty eradication or alleviation. If you look around the world, if you pay attention to US politics, no one is right now talking about poverty. Put the livelihood and future of the poor families and their children at front and center of our dialogue. To that end, I think the Chinese government is doing a great good for the global society by focusing on poverty. So I think China made great progress in reducing poverty, not only in the last 5-10 years, but over the past 40 years due to economic reforms and opening up. I think that trend will be challenged as China faces economic slowdowns, but I hope it will continue to pay attention to the livelihood and well-being of those who suffer or who are at the lower end of the income distribution. I think another direction China should be going, and based on the last 2 days of new policy, I think it probably is going that way, is to build a very comprehensive social insurance and social assistance program by both institutionalize those systems and investing money in them. The European countries and the US spend a lot more as a proportion of their GDP on social welfare, social insurance, social assistance. The US lags somewhat, but still spends more than China. China needs to catch up, especially to balance the urban-rural development in those regards. Lastly, I think China still faces this forever conundrum of urban-rural division. When can we see the abolishment of the hukou system? When I first came to this country in 2001, I met with my doctoral advisor, and we talked about the two societies, similar, different, and I introduced the hukou system. He was shocked. He said, "What is that?"
Can you give us a one sentence definition of the hukou system?
The hukou system in China is the household registration system. If you're born in the rural areas and you have the rural hukou, you cannot move freely to the urban areas. Or even if you did, you cannot go into a urban public school. You cannot benefit from the urban health insurance, housing programs, or any other kind of social welfare programs, such as Dibao. So it's an invisible wall that limits people's human rights, entitlement of basic security and livelihood. I think we need to face that challenge.
Absolutely.
Matthew, have you got anything to add to that?
I mean, that was a pretty good description of hukou. You know, just seeing that play.
I know. I mean, also to the general question, like, how do you rate the Chinese government's performance in eradicating poverty?
Oh,
one
gotcha.
To ten, or
one to
a couple
ten
of senses. Yeah,
man, we'll give it an eight, and a lot of that is for effort and intentionality, right? I think here was my main takeaway from the village and how everyone talked about it. Thanks be to Xi, as the poster child of this effort, and you can see him literally on posters throughout the village, right? It's a lot less Mao posters in rural areas and more Xi posters anymore, and it's exactly because of what Dr. Gao was talking about at the very beginning. It was Xi that first put forth this goal in 2013 that was specific and measurable and time bound, that said, hey, we're going to do this by 2020, and no one else had done that before. There had been money invested, but not a specific goal like this. And so, you know, when people were talking about in Western media complaining that Xi was going to be, you know, emperor for life, and dramatically affecting the political system, with these constitutional changes, instead saying 20 years of Xi is better than 10 years of Xi. So I would say people in rural areas who are living their best lives now, materially better off, they would give it a 8 or 9 or a 10, thanks be to the party.
Wow. Not something you hear all that often here in the United States. Gaoqian and Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and what a delight to speak to both of you. But let's move on to recommendations. But first, it is the end of August now. We are bringing our donation campaign for Seneca to an end. So here's your last opportunity to help us out with a donation or a subscription. Just go to podcast.supchina.com. I want to thank all of you who've been so generous. It's just wonderful that so many of you have been able to help us out. We still need lots more help. So please go to podcast.supchina.com. On to recommendations. Jeremy, you first, then Gaoqian, then Matthew, and I will bat cleanup. Jeremy, what do you got for us?
All right. Something that doesn't have anything to do with China, really. It's a book called Clean, The New Science of Skin by a man named James Hamblin, who's a doctor. And it looks at the skincare industry, or perhaps one could call it the skincare confidence trick, about the enormous economy, skincare. Much of it is based on dodgy science that was first perpetrated by the likes of Procter & Gamble and Unilever, as it was then known, the Lever brothers, who really invented modern marketing of soap and skincare products. And it's fascinating, interesting, and in some ways controversial, because he's kind of a proponent of the idea that you don't really need to wash anything except your hands, and that your skin has a biome, in other words, an ecosystem of little bugs that live on it. And basically, the less you mess with it, the better. But it's not dogmatic. He doesn't try and convert you to the no bathing cult. And it's a wonderful, light, and fascinating read about an industry I hadn't thought that much
about. That is such
about.
A Jeremy Goldcorn kind of book, I tell you. I mean, that is like exactly the kind of thing you would read. I love it. That's great. Actually, I'm going to read that. That sounds perfect, because I'm a big believer in that too. I don't go so far as to say, I mean, I read an article recently that was...
Yeah, I mean, we notice it when we used to have live podcasts, the odor around you, Kaiser, but it's okay.
Hey, you know, some of us are not born with, we have like more apocrine sweat glands than the other kind, because we're East Asian and we don't actually have the said odor. We're blessed.
Does the book specifically address beard care, for COVID beard care?
Jeremy, no. I see things. I can see them right now crawling around in that mess of yours. Okay. Gaochian, what do you have for us, recommendation?
I have my two recent readings. One is a book by my Columbia colleague Neeraj Kaushal. It's called Blaming Immigrants, Nationalism and the Economics of Global Movement. She puts the immigration in both historical and global contexts and talks about why it's not an issue, which is made an issue by politicians. The other book I've been reading is Arthur Kleinman's memoir. It's called The Soul of Care, The Moral Education of a Husband and Doctor. You may know Professor Kleinman as a psychiatrist who has been studying the Chinese societies for many years. And in this memoir, he talks about, reflects about his life and also providing care to his wife when she was very ill, both from professional and personal perspectives. Both are wonderful books.
Excellent recommendations. Thank you. Thank you so much. The Soul of Care. That sounds great. And Blaming Immigrants. Matthew, what do you have for us?
I'm in the middle of a book right now, Chinese Village Socialist State. And it's kind of a classic. I think it came out, at least my copy came out early 90s. And it's just this longitudinal study by three academics of, you know, a Chinese or a county and various villages in this county, looking at how the communist revolution and policies has affected these villages. So they describe it as the party wooing and winning over these people and then losing the hearts and minds of the people, actually, over the course of this study. So what's interesting for me is, you know, in our conversation today, and my interactions with a lot of rural people, that they are, you know, very strong support for the Communist Party. And so kind of this ebb and flow of support, understanding historically how this has played out, you know, in the 70s, 80s, being lost now, perhaps the hearts and minds being won over again, at least some of them. And where does this go in the future?
Fantastic. I'm going to round this out with a yet another book recommendation, which will be, I guess, our fifth book of today. It's Tom Levinson's new book, Money for Nothing. I talked about Tom Levinson and how I met him online because he's the son of Joseph Levinson, who's one of the people who I've idolized for a long time, whose ideas about modern China really were so formative in my thinking. But Tom's new book is a history of modern money and finance. I'm about two-thirds of the way through with it right now. And so far, it focuses a lot on Great Britain in the 17th and 18th centuries, bringing familiar characters like Sir Isaac Newton into, you know, the development of finance. It's really interesting how, you know, our understanding of natural philosophy, of the natural world, of the sort of mathematization of the universe contributed so much to the development of finance. And there's a couple of chapters that focus on the South Seas bubble of 1720, which was just an astonishing thing. I mean, there's so much of this just sounds so much like, you know, the contemporary world of finance that we know. It's an amazing story. It's expertly told. I recommend it without reservation. It's just a phenomenal book. He's a great writer. I'll read anything that he puts out from now on. So, thank you very much, Gaoqian and Matthew, for participating in this.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeremy, it was always great to talk to you.
Absolutely.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.